Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Jeff Dean, ACM Infosys Foundation Award recipient in 2013, which is computing's top prize for young innovators. Jeff is also a world-renowned researcher. Jeff, again, thank you for coming in today for your many outstanding research contributions, and they have so many lasting, significant global impacts. So we really do appreciate you coming in and sharing your expertise with our audience.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Jeff, when did you hear about this honor and being this recipient of such a widely considered prize, this top prize for young computing researchers? And how did you feel at the time? And what was the reaction from your colleagues and from your family?
I guess I first heard about 3 weeks ago that I had jointly won the award with my colleague Sanjay Gamawat. And I was quite honored and very pleased, especially to win it with Sanjay, because we've worked really closely together over the years. And a number of colleagues sent me congratulatory emails, which is nice. And my family, my older daughter wants to be a computer scientist, so she thought that was pretty cool.
Now, you got this extraordinary award, and how do you feel it will impact your work or your influence and your thinking into the future?
Well, I think it's always nice to be recognized for work that you've done, and so I'm mostly very honored and pleased that the community has recognized the work that Sanjay and I have done.
Now, what are your broader life goals that you want to achieve, and how will you achieve them?
So I've always been interested in using computers to help people solve problems that they might have. And I think that there are a number of different areas where computing in general can be used to augment what people are able to do to make certain things easier for people, to complement humans' capabilities with things that computers do really well. And so in general, I'm interested in a broad set of problems along those lines.
Well, we're now going to talk about your work that led to the ACM Infosys Foundation Award. And the first question is about your research paper on MapReduce. Can you talk about how it resolves the core computing challenges of scale in keeping up with the demand for a search service?
Sure. So the origin of the MapReduce paper and the MapReduce work was that Sanjay and I were working on sort of designing the core indexing and crawling system for Google search services. And over the years, we'd done this a few different times as we've tried to scale the system up from, you know, indexing tens of millions of pages to indexing billions of pages. And prior versions that we worked on had essentially hand-parallelized different phases of the indexing process. And so there are maybe 10 or 12 different phases where you start from raw pages on disk and ultimately end up with an inverted index as one of the main data structures. But there are a bunch of separate phases that go into that. One is identifying the language of different pages. Another is trying to eliminate duplicate content where you have different URLs that refer to the same page. And each of these phases was kind of annoying to write because while it was conceptually pretty simple, the actual code to deal with parallelizing the phase and dealing with making that phase fault tolerant because you're trying to run it on a large number of machines actually ended up obscuring the relatively simple computation you were trying to accomplish. And so we kind of squinted at all these different phases and looked at what common interface could we put so we could have a nice separation of a library that deals with lots of the messy issues of automatically parallelizing across lots of machines, dealing with fault tolerance, dealing with failures, and have a nice abstraction for people to write these parallel computations in.
In your answer, you sort of described then the way software can solve what appears to be hardware problems and also kind of address the underlying designs or produce an underlying design that hides the complexity of managing enormous clusters of computers and programmers. Can you get into more detail?
Sure. So Google's computing operations have always been composed at the hardware level of lots and lots of relatively modest-sized computers that are themselves not particularly reliable. So we don't buy high-end machines that have things like redundant power supplies or things like that. We don't have rated disks on each individual machine. Instead, we buy relatively low-cost machines and just buy lots of them because you get more computing power per dollar out of your computing budget this way. And so we end up writing software sort of above the hardware level that takes a whole bunch of these machines and allows you to treat them as kind of a reliable cluster of machines, even if individual machines fail.
One could say that your work led to the advent of cloud computing, or at least many aspects of cloud computing, you know, where computing power is provided as a utility to consumers with all the hardware and implementation details abstracted away. Can you comment on that?
Sure. I mean, I think that when you have a lot of machines, it's generally the case, at least in our environment, that any given use of the machines typically is not using all of the resources on a large cluster at a given time. Instead, you want to multiplex lots of different applications and uses and jobs on top of that underlying hardware. And when you need 1,000 machines, it's nice to be able to ask for them and get them, but you don't need them all the time for some things. You just maybe want to run a large computation and have it finished quickly. And then you want to examine the results by hand or look at what you've computed or other things and then let someone else start using those machines while you're contemplating what to do next. So I think that kind of sharing of underlying resources across a bunch of kind of disparate applications and jobs and even independent users or groups of users is pretty important when you start to get at a large scale, because you don't want those resources to sit idle.
You know, from a technical standpoint then, can you get into some of the underlying design concepts behind MapReduce?
Sure. So the main idea in MapReduce is that the abstraction a programmer writes is they typically write two fairly simple functions. They write a map function, which processes a record of some input data and extracts something of interest from it. So it might extract individual words from a document, and we want to count how often words occur. Or it might, as a more complex example, we might have a list of all the roads in the world and their longitude and latitudes for different segments of the roads. And we might want to coordinate taking every road segment and assigning it to a particular map tile so that we can render all the different map tiles on the Earth, where each map tile might be 1 square mile of the Earth's surface. So you can fairly easily write a computation that says, okay, given this road segment, which map tiles do I need to have that road segment appear in based on the coordinates? And then the reduce function would be, given all the data that I've collected together for a particular map tile, let me actually go ahead and render that map tile. So typically, your map function extracts something of interest. Your reduce function takes everything that has the same key that you've extracted and allows you to process all the different values for that key. And it turns out that if you squint at a lot of problems in the right way, you can actually fit a surprisingly large number of different kinds of computational problems in this framework. So that's kind of the high-level interface that programmers see. Underneath the covers, what's happening is you have a whole bunch of input data, and the system will automatically split that into chunks of work to be done on different machines, potentially. And there's a kind of a master process that will coordinate assignment of work chunks to different machines. And there's a bunch of optimizations under the covers so that, for example, if I have 1,000 machines and some of the chunks of input data are closer to one machine than to another, say they're on the local disk of that machine, the master will actually try to have that machine process the input data that's on its local disk rather than data on some other machine that would have to be transferred across the network. And that's all nicely transparent to the actual user of MapReduce. And another kind of optimization that the system does is it tries to deal with slow machines. So when you have a lot of machines, often one of them will be slow, not because the particular input data it's processing is actually more computationally intensive, but just because maybe that machine is busy doing some other completely unrelated job, and so it doesn't have as much CPU to devote to your particular task. And one of the things the MapReduce implementation will do is actually spawn multiple copies of a particular job in parallel, and kind of whichever one finishes first will take the results from that one. So that actually makes you quite tolerant to having a modest number of slower machines in your cluster. And let's see, what other kinds of tricks are in the implementation? There's a pretty good optimized sorting implementation under the covers for dealing with shuffling lots of data across the network from the output of the different map tasks to the different reduce tasks in the system.
How about things like handling failures?
Right. So because the system, the master in particular, does a lot of bookkeeping for which execution of a particular map task has completed and which ones have not, and then it knows where kind of the intermediate data extracted by the user's map task has been stored. So it can actually fairly easily notice when a machine fails exactly what pieces of the computation need to be re-executed. And because all the execution is essentially not modifying existing state, but is just producing kind of temporary state on disk or in some data structures, it's fairly easy to throw part of it away and replace it with a newly executed version stored on some other machine. And so when you get a failure, you essentially need to, let's say a particular machine has executed 100 different map tasks, you need to re-execute those 100 map tasks on other machines. And one of the nice things about the MapReduce model is if you've broken your work into many more tasks than you have machines, then those 100 map tasks that were executed by the now failed machine, they can be redone by having each of 100 machines re-execute one of the map tasks. And so you get this very nice property that recovery from failures is actually very fast because each machine only needs to re-execute one of the map tasks because you have 100 machines kind of participating in the recovery process.
Now, you've also done some work, I believe, on file systems, working with huge files to be efficiently distributed across thousands of servers. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. So once you have a large cluster of machines, there's a few things you want to be able to do. One is you'd like to be able to treat the whole cluster of machines as a single file system. So all the disks on the different machines would just provide raw storage. And you'd like it to be the case that the file system can deal with failures of individual disks, kind of in a somewhat similar way to the MapReduce master dealing with failures of MapReduce computations. You'd like the file system master to be able to notice that a particular machine has failed, understand what data was stored on its disk, and be able to recover from that by, for example, having other replicas of the chunks of data that that machine stored, and essentially make additional copies on other machines' disks to deal with the fact that this machine's disk has now failed.
Now, can you discuss some of the design concepts behind Bigtable?
Sure. So the raw file system interface is pretty useful, but often people want kind of a higher level interface to data than just a bunch of raw files. And so Bigtable was a system that Sanjay and I and a bunch of other people worked on to essentially give you a pretty a high level interface. It's called Bigtable because you can kind of view it as a three-dimensional spreadsheet in some ways. So you have rows, which have keys, and then you have different columns that have associated information, different kinds of information associated with those rows. And then we have a third dimension of time. So when a particular value is updated, the system allows you to say, should I keep the old value around as well, and just allow you to read that as of a particular timestamp so I can see the old versions and the new versions? Or should I always just keep one version around and keep the newest one around? And so it has this kind of nice property, if your application cares about it, to be able to look at how values have changed over time. And so essentially that three-dimensional model is the basic underlying abstraction provided by Bigtable. And what actually happens underneath the covers is that the row space gets divided into things we call tablets. So contiguous ranges of rows in the sorted row space will be managed by different machines. And when there's, again, this pattern of a master machine that is responsible for coordinating the activity of 100 or 1,000 what are, in the Bigtable system, what are called tablet server machines. And the master kind of decides which machines are going to serve which tablets at a particular time. And so underneath the covers, that tablet abstraction is just a bunch of files stored on the raw file system. But at the higher level, what the interface provides for users is, I'd like to update this row, this set of columns with new data, or I'd like to find out for this row and, you know, these columns or all the columns, what is the current state? And so that's a pretty useful abstraction across a bunch of different applications and higher level products that people are building at Google, including our crawling system, systems for dealing with mapping data and geographic data and satellite imagery, storing user preference data, and so on. All these things can be mapped pretty easily into the Bigtable abstraction. And the nice property is that then as a data set grows or you need more capacity, you can simply add more tablet servers to the machine, and the master will notice that and take care of rebalancing the assignment of who's dealing with which tablets to spread out the load across more machines.
There's limitations or probably compromises you made with your file system, and you solve those problems by incorporating Bigtable. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. I mean, I think the main observation is that you probably want different abstractions at different levels for different kinds of uses. So for some things, a file abstraction is just the right abstraction. We use that for kind of intermediate data in MapReduce computations. You know, sometimes you just have a bunch of files that you want to store, and that's great. But other times you have this kind of higher level view of a more abstract thing, like a row that has a particular key, maybe it's a URL, and you have a crawling system that is, for example, going out and updating the contents of a particular page in our indexing system or in our crawled pages system. So you might go out and fetch CNN.com homepage again, and now you want to store the updated contents in a Bigtable, for example. And that's a little annoying if your only abstraction is a file system, because you then have to build this kind of higher-level indexing system that tells you where CNN.com's current page contents are in some file. And really, that higher-level abstraction of, okay, I have a key with CNN.com, and I have, you know, a contents column that I can update, and I can also look at how the contents have changed over time, various things like that. That's really a better abstraction for that kind of application.
You know, you have GFS evolving into Colossus. Where does it go from there?
Well, so both of those systems, Colossus is essentially GFS with a much more scalable master for the metadata in the file system. Both of those things are still kind of operating at the single cluster level. So if you have a cluster of 10,000 machines, and then you have another cluster with 10,000 machines, that is a different file system. So we have a newer system we've worked on called Spanner that essentially is a higher level interface, more like Bigtable, but allows an abstraction that spans multiple data centers in different geographic locations. So I think that's kind of probably the next major step, is to treat a whole worldwide set of machines as a single abstraction rather than having separate file systems in different clusters or separate Bigtable clusters in different data centers or clusters.
Are there additional ideas that you want to share from the design concepts behind Spanner?
Well, I think one nice property of Spanner is that it builds replication in at a fairly low level, so you can specify that I'd like 5 replicas of this particular kind of data, and the user can give kind of high-level preferences that are either kind of high-level desires or are hard constraints, but are more abstract than I'd like to store it in exactly this cluster. They're more like, I need 2 copies in Europe, and I need 2 copies in the U.S., and I need a copy in Asia. And that, I think, is a nice kind of mix of still allowing users of the system to get the properties they want while allowing the underlying system a bunch of degrees of freedom, so that if one European data center fills up, we can move some of the data that it was managing into another European data center while still satisfying the constraints for that data, because it just said I need to be stored in Europe, not I need to be stored in this particular cluster in the Netherlands or something.
You know, you have a situation where you have a single machine or a couple of machines or a small cluster, and there's issues about failures and performance. What happens when you scale this on a global level? And you already talked about it. Can you get into more detail about that? And that is the impact of scale on otherwise easy problems.
Sure. I mean, I think the main impact is that if you have a relatively small size system, like you have a program you run on one machine or, a handful of machines, you can mostly not worry about failures because the probability of failure is quite low. And if you get a failure during execution of your program, you'll just run it again and probably you'll be fine. And once you start to operate at a large scale, you know, if a machine fails every 3 years or something, if you have 10,000 machines, you're going to expect to lose 10 machines per day or something like that. And so once you're at that scale, you really do have to start treating failure as more of a common case than something you just don't have to worry about. And so most of our large-scale systems do have to deal with failure and deal with it at a fairly integrated level within the abstraction they're trying to provide. So, for example, in MapReduce, you know, it deals with failures because when you're running large computations on thousands of machines, you are going to get some failures. Bigtable deals with failures in similar ways. You know, if a tablet server fails, the master has logic to go ahead and deal with what about all the tablets that master was serving. And I think that's a nice property that the underlying abstraction can then worry about failure, and that frees higher level users of the system to not have to worry about it in their use of the system.
And I guess there's also a link to performance as well.
Right. So you dealing with failures, you'd like recovery to be very fast because if you really want higher level users of the system to not have to worry about failures, it means they have to not be impacted very much when a failure does occur and your system takes some sort of corrective action. And also, I think failures are actually kind of a easier case in some sense than other kinds of more insidious behavior that we, you know, you tend to observe once you have enough machines. So things like, we have all these rack switches that connect, you know, groups of maybe 20 or 40 machines to the cluster level network. And if a rack switch fails, then all of a sudden 20 or 40 machines kind of drop off the face of the earth. And that's pretty easy to recognize. But sometimes rack switches start to behave badly in the sense that they lose half the packets sent through them, but still kind of work enough for them to look alive from the point of view of systems that are trying to detect, is a machine alive? Because they'll send a ping packet, and eventually a ping packet will get through, and it'll look fine, albeit a bit slow. But those machines are really behaving very slowly and very strangely. You can't really treat them as working properly. And so the system also needs to recognize those kinds of things and have the ability to deal with very slow machines at a fairly rapid sort of recognition and taking corrective action.
Now, earlier you mentioned that your co-winner of the Infosys Foundation Award is Sanjay Gamawat. And so what is your style of collaboration? How do you work through controversies or areas of debate where you're at sort of opposite ends of the spectrum?
So it's funny, actually. Sanjay and I have worked together for many years, probably 15 or 16 years. We were both researchers at Digital Equipment Corporation before we both came to Google. And so we've worked together on a number of different systems, you know, everything from, you know, high-performance Java compilers, you know, low-level profiling systems, which we worked on at Digital. And then at Google, we've worked on, you know, MapReduce and Bigtable and Spanner and various other systems. When we're working together, we actually often write code together at the same screen. And I find that we're pretty effective because we often have the same view on how to solve particular problems. And when we don't, we kind of throw out a bunch of ideas and we each kind of pretty quickly understand the pros and cons of what the other person is suggesting and can do a pretty good job of assessing, you know, what is the right decision to make here. And we generally don't have big disagreements. We have kind of data-driven discussions, and then eventually we settle on one thing. And we often kind of will work together for a for a session where we'll put together a little to-do list in a text file of things we want to get done, and then kind of we'll figure out, okay, let's do the first thing, and then we'll check that off, figure out, okay, we're working together at the same screen, maybe there's some piece of work that we now understand well enough that we can go off and work on that independently and then come back together when those things are done. So it's a very fluid kind of thing. He usually types because he's pickier about spacing. So I kind of prop my feet up on his desk and we work together.
You know, the internet is growing at just such a tremendous rate. And you already talked about GFS and Colossus and Spanner, which in my mind at least sort of is following the evolution of the internet. So how does this growth change what you do?
Well, I think, you know, there's several kinds of growth that are important these days. One is there's just going to be there already is a bit of a flood of video data, and video data is very large relative to almost any other kind of data that we have. And so dealing with that magnitude of data when, you know, everyone will probably have, you know, everyone already has a cell phone camera that can easily take videos. So there's just a lot more video data being produced in the world. And video also requires a lot of computation if you really want to run sort of, you know, extensive algorithms to really do a good job of computer vision as understanding what kind of information is in this video. Is it a video of people playing volleyball? You know, that would be useful to know. And the algorithms that we have today to understand that are pretty computationally expensive. So it's both a lot of data and also a lot of computation to do interesting perceptual tasks with that data. And then I also think that in other fields of science, there's starting to be kind of a very large amount of data being produced. Things like, you know, being able to read genetic data at low cost is starting to produce a flood of genetic data. There's other scientific fields. Astronomy, for example, now has telescopes that have much higher resolution sensors and are sort of more continuously taking photos rather than taking still images. So they're producing kind of very large streams of data at all times. And I think, you know, in all these different cases, there's just large amounts of data, but also large amounts of computation you want to apply to that data in order to do interesting things with it.
Now, Jeff, you've got quite an incredible research history, you know, very, very extensive. You've worked on a lot of stuff. It's going to have lasting impact. Is there some valuable lessons you wish to share from maybe some of your top research areas in the past?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things I enjoy doing is finding new areas to work in and bringing the skills that I do have to apply to problems in some other area, because I find that that's a really effective way of collaborating with other people who have skills that are really complementary to the ones that I have. And they're also kind of the most interesting projects because, you know, you take a small group of people, each of whom has sort of different complementary skills, and collectively you can do something that none of you could do individually. And you also pick up a lot of knowledge from working with people with those other skills. So I think that's one of the really nice things about sort of moving around between different research areas over the years. I don't know. I think in terms of ideas and lessons, I think that's certainly one of the main ones is be willing to try to take your skills and apply them to different domains.
Now, if you can talk about your current research interests and future research interests and their broader implications and applications.
Sure. So for the last year and a half or so, I've been working and collaborating with a bunch of people on essentially scaling up large-scale machine learning systems. There's kind of a subfield of machine learning called deep learning that tries to apply kind of biologically inspired neural network-like systems to a whole bunch of different kinds of areas. And those techniques are getting kind of state-of-the-art results in a bunch of different domains now because of the fact that we now have more computational power to apply to these problems. We have a lot more data in a lot of these areas to train these systems on. And so in terms of, say, basic areas of perception, like speech recognition, image recognition, video understanding, those kinds of things. This seems to be one of the most promising approaches to tackle those kinds of problems. And we now have systems that can apply enough computational power and enough data to the problem that they can actually get pretty good results. I think the basic areas of perception in terms of visual and auditory recognition are things that computers in the past have not been very good at. And I think if you're able to really do a good job of making systems that can do can much better than past systems, you know, trying to be as close to human level capability as we can in those areas of perception, I think that'll really change how people interact with computers.
Okay, so I've got sort of a multi-threaded kind of question here, multifaceted. And, you know, I know that, or I read that Kurzweil has joined your organization as one of your directors of engineering. And then you have this knowledge graph work that's occurring within your organization. And so the implications of that, there's Google Now. There's this idea of a Star Trek computer or sort of emulating that concept within the system or within the cloud where, you know, you go to it at least twice a day and perhaps more, and you get to a point where you just can't live without it. And then there's this also this idea that something like 16% of the questions that go into Google are totally new, and having the ability to be able to answer those questions directly rather than providing links. So, you know, so all of these bits and pieces, Google Now, Knowledge Graph, the Star Trek concept, what do you think about all of those things, or Kurzweil and this idea of singularity?
Well, I think, you know, it's kind of a natural evolution of how Google's services should be used, right? The very earliest Google search systems essentially did provide just a ranked order of documents, which is not nearly as good as what the user really wants is they have a question and they want an answer to that question. So if we're able to build systems that can actually do a better job of understanding natural language, you know, understanding images, understanding speech for the user to input their question, you know, I think we can make a much more fluid system than one where you just type a query and you get 10 links back, because that's still a fair amount of effort from providing those 10 links to going to actually having the user, you know, get the answer to their question. So the tighter we can make that cycle of the user having a question and the system providing an answer, the better it'll be for all of our users. The other thing is that I think often for a particular user, we may know something about you, and that can sort of inform and influence what kind of answer you would probably want. So, for example, I'm a vegetarian, and I really like spicy food. So if I step off the plane in some new city that I've never been to before, you know, it'd be nice if when I ask about restaurants, the system understands that I probably want spicy food and vegetarian food and would guide the selection of answers it gives me to, you know, take that information into account. Or if I'm a neuroscientist and I'm visiting a new university, it'd be nice if I pull out my map and it highlights the neuroscience building because it knows that that's a pretty likely destination for me. So I think there's actually the ability to really tighten some of the cycle times in understand, because we understand a lot about the user and a lot about what kinds of questions they're asking now or are likely to ask, where we can actually do a better job of giving them information when they want it.
This is a two-parter question here. What do you see as the most difficult challenges in research, and then what are the areas of controversy?
Well, I mean, I think the research is a pretty general. I'll assume you mean computer science research. And, you know, I think really having machines do a good job of understanding natural language, that is a pretty fundamental problem. And I think if you're able to do a good job of that, you can actually simplify a lot of systems that we have today, because you can then have the machine do a good job of really understanding the nuances of what it is you're asking, understand by reading lots of text what is the most salient piece of that in order to give you a more concise answer. So that certainly strikes me as one very interesting and very difficult research problem. And I don't think we really have a handle on exactly how to solve that, but I think making progress in that area will be pretty important. In terms of controversies, you know, I tend not to focus too much on controversies. I think, you know, there is a controversy of people worrying about computers looking over, you know, their shoulder a lot and understanding perhaps too much from a privacy perspective. And that's in part driven by the fact that computational devices and computational power is dropping in price all the time. But, you know, in some sense, I think a lot of that is just deciding what products and features people build in, into systems. You know, you can, for example, if the computer knows that I'm vegetarian and like spicy food, but uses that in a way that helps me, I view that as a positive. If it used that in a way that's negative, because I felt like it was invading my privacy, that would be a bad thing. And so there's always this tension of, you know, using a user's information and context and knowledge of what kinds of properties that user has to affect the behavior of different systems. I think that can pose some controversy. But in general, I think we can improve users' experience and lives from using that data.
Okay, let's reach out a little bit further into the future in that what do you see as sort of the big burning challenges and questions maybe in 10 years that, you know, 14 and 15-year-old women and or young women and men would be interested in that would get them into computing? You know, some passionate kind of problems that, you know, people want to get involved. And I'm talking from a computing standpoint. And what would this research look like? You know, what would you consider to be the big topics in, let's say, 10 years? And can you paint sort of a picture of what that would look like?
Sure. So, I think in 10 years, there will still be huge unanswered questions and interesting research to do in the area of building truly intelligent computing systems. So systems that can understand from text and video and speech, other kinds of things, exactly what a user is asking, what information do they want to, what should a system provide, and also in analyzing large amounts of data, be it, you know, perceptual data from video sensors or video cameras, or large amounts of genetic data. I think there's a lot of interesting kind of intersections of interesting problems in the field of computational biology and computer science is how do you deal with what's going to be an incredible flood of genetic data because the cost of obtaining that is getting very low. How can you apply computational algorithms to make using that data cost effective and useful for people? There's a real opportunity, I think, to provide very personalized medicine and also to really understand things at a genetic level a lot better than we do today by taking advantage of lots of data. And there's tons and tons of interesting computational problems in there. Because I think at some point the cost of actually doing genetic sequencing will be dominated by the actual computational cost of dealing with that data, not so much by the actual sort of chemistry of reading the genetic sequences. Those are just a few areas that I think are interesting. And in general, I think computing is reaching the point where there's so much influence that you can have as a computer scientist because software is so malleable and so adaptable to be applied to lots of different problems that it's really an exciting field because, you know, you can have a group of two or three or four people produce something that is used by, used to be a million people was a lot, but now you can actually get hundreds of millions or billions of people using your software and benefiting from capabilities that it has. And that's tremendously exciting. You know, I think there are very few careers where small groups of people can have that kind of influence. And that's why I think, you know, you see a lot of young people excited about this field and continuing to be excited about it.
This next question has kind of three components, and that is about what are the things that inspired you or created challenges for you in your education at the University of Washington and University of Minnesota that were catalysts or what would it call inflection points in your lifetime and contributions, and apply that same kind of idea to your work and then perhaps extend that even further to perhaps mentors who guided you in some way. So things that drove you that were inflection points from your educational experience, from your work experience, and from your mentors?
Sure. So when I grew up in Minnesota, I was actually living in Minnesota from 5th to 10th grade, and then we moved away. But while I was there, the state of Minnesota had this pretty cool, very advanced for its time system where different schools throughout the state could call, have accounts on this large centralized time sharing system. And so you had all these different students, logging into this centralized, mainframe machine to run educational software. And there were also lots of kind of interactive applications there. So you could essentially do text chat with people, you know, at other schools. And there'd be chat rooms, things like this. This is all before the internet was developed. And so I think, and one of the things you could do there was play kind of interactive computer games. So they had a adventure game that someone had written that was actually multi-user, so you could, you know, interact with other people in the same environment and follow them around. And one of the guys who had written that game was a graduate student at University of Minnesota, and he decided he would publish the source code, which was written in Pascal, as a way of letting people learn about this. And this was before kind of open source software really existed. And so I managed to download a copy of this and print it. It was like 400 or 500 pages. But I learned a lot about writing software from examining this code. And I actually wanted to get it to run on my own home machine, which had a couple of serial ports. So I essentially took this multi-user game and wanted to get it to run on my single-user computer. And as a byproduct of that, I learned a lot and also ended up implementing kind of a cobbled-together multi-user OS on top of the single-user OS so that I could have multiple serial ports hook up and do this. So I think that was a just kind of a freak occurrence that I ended up stumbling across the source code that this person, Alan Kleitz, had published. So that was kind of interesting. That kind of really got me into programming because then I could modify the program to do what I wanted, and I would learn a lot this way. The second thing was at University of Minnesota in my senior year, I took a parallel computing class as an elective from Vipin Kumar, who was a new professor there at the time. He's now a department chair. And I think, you know, that really got me interested in the field of parallel computing. Prior to that, I'd kind of just been focused on building, you know, non-parallel software. And I think there's a tremendous potential for parallel computing because it essentially allows you to look out, you know, 10 or 15 years to what will be possible on a single computer in 10 or 15 years by using, you know, 1,000 or 10,000 computers today. And that essentially gives you the same kind of computational capability that will eventually be available in a single machine. So Vipin Kumar's course was really kind of eye-opening to me. I really enjoyed that. The third thing I think is just having lots of colleagues over the years that have taught me lots of things. So my advisor in graduate school, Craig Chambers, taught me a tremendous amount about how to do research, how to find interesting problems, how to, you know, pick what is important to work on, and how to build good software abstractions. He had a really good knack for sort of picking the right abstraction. And so I learned a tremendous amount in graduate school from Craig. And over the years, I've also had a number of other colleagues skilled in different areas of computer science that have taught me a lot. And everyone I've worked with has taught me something. And so I think that's kind of a real thing that you want in a career is to have it interesting people around you that have different skills so that you can kind of pick up what they know.
This is a broad question in the sense that you choose the topic area, and it could be in the computing science field or it could be in other domains. What do you see as maybe one or two top challenges facing us today?
Oh, boy, that is pretty broad. You know, I think I'll pick a few. So one is the internet is connecting, you know, 2 billion people today or something like that. But there's still a tremendous number of people in the world that are not benefiting from this fundamental technology that enables so many other things. And so I think figuring out ways to get the entire world connected to the internet, and along with that, have everyone in the world have access to high-quality educational materials. You know, I think the revolution that's happening in online education is going to be a tremendously powerful thing, especially for people once they have internet access, to have access to, you know, really high-quality lecture materials and so on. that will be a really great thing. Second thing is, I think, individualized medicine, where we are able to understand a tremendous amount of, you know, past data, being able to essentially look at outcomes from analyzing large data sets of people with similar conditions to the ones you have, what kinds of treatments worked well and what kinds of things did not work well. That strikes me as an area where we don't really have this capability today, because the data isn't really necessarily in electronic form. It's very fragmented, so different hospitals and organizations have their own data but don't easily have access to other hospitals' data. I think there's a tremendous opportunity there to make great strides in improving healthcare through the use of computational methods and data analysis. And third, I think we don't really know what kinds of applications will be possible once computers are able to do a much better job of perceptual tasks, learning from very limited numbers of examples as humans can. So, for example, if you tell a child, oh no, that's not a truck, that's a bus, the child is able to understand, oh, I have my mental model and I need to adjust it slightly because now that's a bus and I thought it was a truck. Computers are not able to really make that kind of very sudden changes in their model without lots of examples. And I think if we can build systems that can learn from experience very quickly and can do a good job of understanding perceptual data and natural language, that's going to really open up a lot of interesting applications that don't exist today purely because the underlying capabilities aren't good enough.
Well, Jeff, we're actually at the end of the interview. I know you've got another meeting to go to shortly, so you're this tremendous pioneer. You've laid a foundation, and you're continuing to lay a foundation which will have global impact. And, you know, we are indeed fortunate that you came in to do this interview, and thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom with our audience.
Oh, Stephen, thank you for taking the time to chat with me. I enjoyed it.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Jeff Dean, ACM Infosys Foundation Award recipient in 2013, which is one of computing's top prize for young innovators. Jeff is also a world-renowned researcher.